Hello and welcome to this episode of Move, Breathe, Live with me, Wibbs Coulson, or sometimes my wife, Jenny Wren. Just a quick note to say that throughout this episode, myself and my guests sometimes do get a little bit potty mouthed. There is the occasional profanity. So if you find that right now you need to listen through headphones, if you've got kids around or something else, then it might be an idea to do so or come back later to this episode. I hope you enjoy the episode and will let me know what you think. I look forward to seeing you on the other side. Today's podcast is brought to you by me. Today's advert, I'm going to put myself out there, and I'm hoping that maybe if you enjoy this and you enjoy the conversations I have, you might well enjoy coming and joining me, my beautiful wife, Spirit Wren, Jenny, on our online platform. We offer 11 weekly classes, which includes meditation, breath work for people with long COVID, what else? Just yoga and movement. So the movement is much more kind of body weight centric, trying to understand your body, somewhere between my anatomy and motion work, but put into a class and just working the hell out and making you feel like you've done some work. So it's 11 weekly classes for the price of just £15 a month. So it's pretty cheap. Not that you should ever look at it this way, but it works at about 48p a class or something. So all classes are live and they're all recorded. So if you can't make one live, you can always catch up after via the members only section on our website. So if you're interested, please do head to mandukyayoga.com, mandukya.com. Oh, hang on, mandukyayoga, mandukyayoga.com just become a member. In fact, just ignore that. Just go to mandukyayoga.com, and in the top bar, it will come down as become a member. Come and join us. Like I say, we've got a lovely growing community of nearly 100 members. We practice, there's early morning classes, there's midday classes, there's evening classes, something for everyone. And both me and Jenny get to teach you. So hopefully it'll be something that you might be interested in. If so, come and join us over at mandukyayoga.com and we will see you all soon. Enjoy the episode and we'll see you on the other side. And welcome back, guys, to another episode. Here we are today welcoming Mr. Tony Riddle, the natural lifestylist. This is only going to be a brief intro. I'm sure you just want to get into the episode. But in case you haven't heard of him, he has been featured on many a podcast with the likes of Rich Roll, Rangan Chatterjee. He was on Chris Evans' radio show a while back. So he's been around. It was an absolute pleasure chatting to him. We got into everything which I love, being barefoot, running barefoot. We discussed movement and play and education and how kids should be more, or should be allowed to be kids more and all sorts. So hopefully you enjoy it. Please, as always, do like, share, subscribe, rate it, all of that stuff. Get it out there. Let's get more people hearing about this kind of stuff. And yeah, we'll see you all soon. Have a great week and we'll see you next week. Well, welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Move, Breathe, Live. It's a pleasure to have my guest today. It's a chap by the name of Tony Riddle. Some of you may or may not know him. He's just released his book. I'm going to hand you over to him, and he can tell you a little bit about himself and what his, why he's here, I guess. We'll stick it with that. Keep it open for now, Tony, and we'll take it down from there.
Yeah, so why I'm here, as in why I'm here on the podcast, so why is Tony here?
I mean, that's a big bigger question. One, right? I mean, that's an even bigger question. We can get to that towards the end.
So my name's Tony Riddle. I am a husband, father, natural lifestyle coach. I'm a barefoot endurance athlete and just recently now published author. So what does all that mean? So I think that it's all one thing, what it is to be a human, really. And it's my human experience within all of that. What's unraveled of late is the book Be More Human, which is kind of a whole understanding of what a philosophy is that I live by and coach by, which is really to deconstruct or dismantle the ways of living that aren't serving us, and then to reconnect to ways of living that are in more in sync with our human biology, that enable us to thrive, which are also better for planetary health, not just personal health, you know? So that's really the idea around the philosophy. So that within the book, I cover movement and play and breath and being, I call it being and breath. Yeah. Sleep, rest, indoor and outdoor living, and then eating and drinking, which is really, it's not so much about what you should be eating. It's more about looking at your digestion, how you absorb foods, and then perhaps looking at where the foods are from and making the best choices really based on an evolutionary model, but also what you as an individual needs.
Yeah.
We have fundamental needs, of course, and that's also highlighted in the book, you know, fundamental physical needs, social needs, spiritual needs that ultimately will lead to emotional well-being. And so that's essentially the book and the philosophy, and also what my coaching philosophy is and how I see clients, and also yep. have an online community called the Nat Life Tribe, and it's very much centered around this, and there's movement classes and breath work, and there's a meetup once a week where we discuss kind of lifestyle and what's happening in one's week, really.
Yeah. Amazing. I think I can't remember quite how I first found you. I think because I was quite, I've never done any of the, I've done a few of the in-person courses, but like I've never done the MoveNat training, but I remember something around MoveNat, and then that introduced me to, I don't know, like a rewilding thing, which I think you had been part of in the past. And then that kind of, I think that led me to you. And then I loved how you kind of broke down like this idea of like the human zoo, and actually not just pretending, for want of a better word, you know, I think there's a lot of people who are kind of, what should we say? They're kind of doing the natural movement and the natural lifestyle. I'm inverting commas for that who aren't, people aren't watching, but like, but really they're still going about living a life of modernity, to, for want of a better word. You know, it's very much just like a, they're not really walking their talk as such. And I think that's one of the things which is so like cool about you as someone who's really kind of going out there and just walking the walk.
Well, it happens, right? And again, it's, we also have to understand that everyone's on their path, and they're on individual parts of that path, and all at different layers even as to where we are even sitting in consciousness, perhaps we could say. But
yeah,
I had a business that had an actual lifestyle philosophy running through it, or weaving through it. It was mainly movement orientated, but we did have a core philosophy in there. And it kind of came through from the days of Wild Fitness. We had MoveNat, people that were studying MoveNat with us. We had a barefoot running philosophy that was weaved into it, that we were in the early stages before Vivo Barefoot became Vivo Barefoot, before
yeah.
Born to Run was released, all of that. We were kind of trailblazing, if you like, within coaching a barefoot movement and running philosophy.
Yeah.
And then it started to move towards lifestyle, except I wasn't living it. I knew it all, you know, yeah. But just wasn't living it all. So I could, and that unfortunately means that it does come across as, oh, I know it all. But actually, well, behind the scenes, people know, well, yeah, but if you know it all, why aren't you living it? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
There is that, but we also have to have compassion of where people are at that moment in time in life. And for me, I had two young daughters, I had a gym that I was supporting, as well as coaches that I was supporting, and had this philosophy, and people would come in to be inspired and coach, and I'd run workshops. And one particular day I'm there just coaching this room of personal trainers, movement coaches, whoever. And it was in that moment, it was in a disused railway building in West Hampstead. And a train blasted past the building, just shook it. And it kind of shook something in me. And I had one of these moments, a real epiphany, really, but a eureka, you could call it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a fraud.
Right.
And it was in that moment of realization of, there were elements of walking the talk. You know, they were.
Yeah.
But it's then walking the walk. And so it came in crashed in really into my consciousness that I was coaching a movement philosophy and I nailed a lot of the movement philosophy, but here I am discussing zoo humans versus wild humans and what it is to live this wild existence, except I'm keeping a business afloat to match the modern day zoo equivalent, understanding what success is, not what the wild human success is. It's actually just getting your needs met and becoming, you know, wild, connected, empowered being. That would be success really, and that's innately in us. So it was the breaking down of me really in that moment, that realization. And it was very obvious then, it was glaringly obvious that what I had to do is, if that's the breaking down of the old, and it took bankruptcy and took all kinds of things around that business model for that to happen, for Tony to really understand, to walk the walk, to look at sleep. How does sleep, what does sleep look like in nature? Not just what does movement like, what does digestion look like in nature? What does breathing look like in nature? What does rest look like? What does the family dynamics look like, you know? And then understanding there's macros of all of that, but what are the micro elements of that, which we love to look through the lens in the human zoo, even to things perhaps like webs like sleep studies, right?
So, everyone
needs 8 hours and we need to look at melatonin, we need to look at this. And then you go, well, how does that look in nature? Because for me, if I knew what I knew now, even when I had my business, when I was smashing in 16-hour days, if I knew what I knew now, that I would have been more successful within that model. That's the point.
Yeah.
You know, you can still be killing it and not killing you. But what I was doing was killing it and killing me. And I'd listen to all the entrepreneurial speakers. Yeah, man, you could be crushing it, killing it. But, you know, if we end up looking like, we end up looking like, 40-year-olds who are having toddler breakdowns, you know, half the time, you know, it's incredible. Yeah.
I mean, what you said, like in the book as well, I found it fascinating because, you know, especially at the moment, you know, it's kind of cool it's super cool in many ways of that, the fact that things like science, you know, podcasts and stuff are getting so popular. And, you know, we're kind of looking more at, like, I think of Andrew Huberman in his podcast about neuroscience and stuff. And then Matthew Walker with his book and all of that. But, you know, I remember, I think I might have been on my podcast when I had Brian McKenzie on and we were chatting sleep at one point, you know, and we were talking about the fact that, you know, everyone is hammered in the 8 hours sleep. But then when you look at, you know, and I guess they do have a routine and stuff, but you look at most monks and most, you know, people who practice a spiritual life, they get about 3 hours sleep, really. Do you know what I mean? They're up meditating and they're putting their brain into that deep restful place throughout the day. So actually you don't have to just get a solid 8 hours sleep to be able to get your three cycles of, you know, deep rest or whatever it is. Actually, if you can find a way in which you're downshifting during the day, you're finding those deep rests, the 8 hours isn't a necessity. It's, as you said in the book, it's a zoo, you know, it's our zoo life way to get the three deep sleeps.
Yeah, I think there's the understanding of a lot of those sleep studies that suggest we need 8 hours. And if you don't get 8 hours, then you have a sleep debt. And then here are the symptoms of those sleep debts. Here are the conditions. So obesity, and inflammation, and
diabetes, etc.
Diabetes, a long list of these conditions. But then when you look, not just say monks, because again, I'm talking like what's the natural cycle? Where can we go? We can only really go to natural environments, natural habitats, and natural beings within them. So we can look to indigenous cultures, right?
Yeah.
And there's a study of three independent tribes. I've mentioned this on a lot of podcasts before. So if anyone's tuning in, like, oh, here he goes with his three tribes. But it's so important to get it because you might hear it again and go, oh, there's something else within that. It's three independent tribes. They've been living the same way for tens of thousands of years. And no one sleeps for 8 hours. Mm. And yet they don't have diabetes. They don't have obesity. They don't have inflammation. So, yeah, there's other lifestyle factors. Of course there are. But if it was just down to a sleep debt, as we're led to believe, for missing 8 hours, we'd have to question it anyway, because we're talking about hostile environments.
Yeah.
And we've traversed, as a species, hostile environments. With predators, right? So would it make sense then to be asleep for 8 hours? If that, no, from an evolutionary perspective, no. So it has to be a modern phenomena in terms of the evolutionary clock, right? And so when they then looked at, they broke away in the study and they looked at the Hadza, for instance, like tens of thousands of years living the same way. And they broke away and looked at 33 members. And firstly, they always have to have a fire going, right? Because the fire is always present. And so you have to be awake to tend to the fire. So they sleep and wake, a sleep-wake cycle, right? They're doing it all through the night. And they look after kids and they fix their weapons and they're doing whatever they're doing, partying, smoking even, you know? and then off they go again. And there's this rhythm to it. But they looked at 200 out of 220 hours, the whole 33 members are only ever asleep for 18 minutes together. They're all doing this at different sleep-wake cycles throughout the night. So
yeah.
There's a lot said there. And what the breakaway for me was then looking at, well, what are the environmental shifts that have occurred? And so if you were to strip away the house, the lighting, you'd immediately be affected by, I mean, all lighting, not just in the house. I mean, outside the house, right? Because that would also be illuminating. So we ruined all the street lights, the building lights, the inside the home, the smartphone device. And then what would happen is it would get darker over time. You would still have moonlight, starlight, and you'd have firelight, right? And that's known as biological darkness. All of that is known as biological darkness. And in biological darkness, we still produce a super hormone that we all know now as melatonin.
Yeah.
And the reason we say super hormone, because it's not just the sleep hormone. Guess what? Oh, it has anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, anti-cancer, what else is there? The digestive system. So it regulates the three main regulatory systems. So insulin's in there, ghrelin, leptin.
Yeah.
Okay. So melatonin does that. So if we were to say, well, actually, in that case, I just need to look at the temperature, because temperature also affects melatonin, not just lighting, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we know lighting and temperature. So the temperature goes down at night. We don't have the ability to create sunrise at sunset by switching lights on. So there are two key things that I could be doing to minimize the risk of diabetes, obesity, and inflammation.
Yeah.
And cancer as we know it at the moment. There's
some
incredible studies coming through that. But it's early, right? Early days. But that means that, well, hang on, I don't need 8 hours. No, I just need to clean up the environment of which I'm choosing to go to sleep in. And that ultimately will then shift the habit within that habitat and my very being within it. So my behavior changes and my being will change through changing the habitat. And what can we do? The bedroom is the most obvious thing, right?
I was going to say, so in your, in your house, let's say, because I know if anyone follows you, you know, there's plenty of clips and bits of you rolling out your mattress in the morning or back in the morning and all sorts. But, you know, let's say lighting, we'll take the two you just said, lighting and heating, for want of a better word, you know, in your bedroom, what's the situation of pre-bed lighting and, you know, or any lighting at all, I guess?
I think what it would look like is what I'd advise any client on, right, is to firstly think about that environment is you're spending 8 hours in it. So that's a third of your life, right? You don't have to be asleep, but eight hours are in that environment. And so I have another message of inorganic consumption will lead to inorganic behaviors and being. Yeah. So organic consumption would lead to more of an organic behavior
and
being. So firstly, look at, right, I'm in there for 8 hours. What's the air quality, not just the air temperature? What's the quality of air that I'm going to be consuming for 8 hours? However, my breathing pattern at this stage, we can get to breathing later, right? On the benefits of different breathing patterns. But what is it I'm choosing to inhale through breathing, but also through my skin, because I inhale through that. So what are the materials? What's the paint, the glues, the bedding, the soft furnishings, all of that. And how can I make that more of an organic expression experience for me? So this is where in the book, the rest of it's pretty much for free because we have it all inside of us. This ability to change, but the bedroom, you might have to spend some money to change that environment. And this might be for some bit over time, you know, like
this
month, might even be a pillowcase. Let's make it an organic cotton pillowcase or something. Like this month.
Yeah.
Air purifiers, great, clean up the air quality. Lighting, what could you do with lighting? You can just buy direct amber bulbs, you can buy circadian lighting now. you could wear amber glasses, and there's different kind of lenses, let's say. There's one called Duggos. They're doing like three different types of lenses. Okay. One's quite clear for daytime screen.
Mm-hmm.
Not daytime outside, I just mean daytime screen.
Yeah.
They have another that's like an amber wash that you can then drive with. It's also been approved by driving safety standards, which is incredible. Because, of course, if you're on a late light commute home driving or on the tube even, you're getting blasted by the same light, which will suppress melatonin, which then will lead to this cascade of what we're leading to be believe is the sleep debt.
Yeah.
And then that's lighting, air quality, materials. Just try and think of it being an organic, an inorganic experience or an organic experience. How can I make that more organic? So the other things would be plants, of course.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've just seen your big plant behind you and I wanted to come onto plants. I don't know if you can see it or not. We're a bit limited in here, but upstairs in our bedroom, we've got a massive forest of plants.
Yeah, it's so important, but not only for the, because again, it's some of it's, NASA printed this list of 10 amazing air purifying plants, but it's, there is also, we have to understand how many we would need, where they need to be positioned, and are they nighttime plants versus a daytime plant going to clean up the air? And you know, it's, there's a lot around that, but the benefits are seeing something organic and natural in that environment, because it's not just air quality and materials. It's also the organic expression of something. So it gives us a better understanding. Well, firstly, it's interconnected. We are nature. We're not separate from it. And even chart like flip books or screensavers are proving to lower heart rate and blood pressure as a connection to nature. So if you bring more organic matter in, visually, you get the visual stimulation. So there's nature. You're also dropping into a more parasympathetic state because you're seeing something more natural. And void of that, you're then looking at one linear box that you spend 8 hours in, and you move from that linear box probably down some steps
into another linear box.
Into another linear box with the same air quality, and probably sit behind a chair, eat something that you might have been eating day after day after day after day. So it means there's no real new relationship even to food, and no new sensory stimulation from walking from one room to another. And then choose the same mode of transport, and then possibly go into the same linear experience of work, right?
Yeah. So
it's trying to find, you know, experience, I guess.
Experience.
Something that's more natural within that, whether it's that's within the home or on the commute, or even the way that you choose to go down the stairs in the morning or back up the stairs. You know, you could even think, right, let's crawl today. We were talking about crawling earlier, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Why not crawl up the stairs? Why not do like an inverted crawl downstairs?
Yeah.
Why do we have to go to a gym? You know,
exactly. Like,
we have a home that you could move around with in such extraordinary ways if you entered more of what would be a playful state of mind, that if you observe kids, you'll immediately understand that's within you too. It just got, unfortunately, cultured out of you.
I mean, this is literally everything here was just what I wanted to, I mean, I definitely want to get onto bare feet and breathing. Absolutely. But I just what you said there was, anyone who's watching, I was waving my pen in the air furiously. I mean, I'm personally not a gym person. I've never been able to get my head. I mean, I used to go, but I hated it. And I never could get my head around the false air, the bad, loud music. And, you know, okay, I listen to sometimes my own music, and probably many people would say that's bad. Listening to noisy metal and rock and stuff at times. But, you know, I like being in nature, and I like also just exploring by crawling and climbing and, you know, using my own body weight. And the play bit that you said for me is like, it's so important for us as humans. And again, some of this originally got sparked by Katie Bowman back in the day when I first read some of her stuff, but like the idea of like movement and exercise and how, you know, exercise is this compared to movement, which is this. And actually by learning to like shed those layers of cultural, you know, appropriation, or that sounds wrong, but you know, of what is seen as appropriate for us to do as adults, of you know, not climbing around and crawling. And you know, I walk my dogs, and my playtime is I'll climb trees while the dogs are running through the woods. I'll be climbing the trees and jumping around and swinging and all sorts. But you get some weird looks. You do get some odd looks.
Yeah, I think firstly, I go always enter it with the, and I coach others in this, you know, that it's none of my business what other people think of me.
Mm-hmm.
But also, we sometimes it comes from our internal world that we think people are giving us a certain look, and we never know actually who we might actually we might inspire at that moment.
Yes, yeah.
And so there's a character in the book, Yehudi, who Yehudi, I coach,
yeah.
And his commute was very much coming from this. What we unpacked over time with him was to come in from this playful state of mind. But as a in the book, in, now he's 81, but up until, you know, his commute that I mentioned in the book was around about 79, I guess, 79 mm-hmm. years of age. And so his commute was this opportunistic, playful state of mind again, where he would walk down to the tube and he'd walk down the steps and he'd get on, he'd be in his barefoot shoes, his, you know, Vivo barefoot shoes in this case, get on the tube, and he's on the tube, and then he'd, people are often say, would you like a seat? Because he's like late 70-year-old at this time. But no, I'm okay. And then he'd hang off the rails, right? So he'd be hanging off the rails above. Then he'd squat when the doors open. And then when the doors close, he then surfs. And then the next stop, squat, doors open, hangs, and you hang, surf, squat.
Yeah.
And so bet you 100% he's going to have people staring at him. But 100%, well, 90%, let's say, will be going, oh my God, there's like a late 70-year-old dude here I've just offered to see and look what he's doing.
Yeah.
That's inspiring, you know, yeah. Hugely inspiring. So I think also, we mentioned MoveNet earlier. The first time I met Erwin was like, it was pre-kids. So it's probably around 13, 14 years ago. Well, there was no MoveNet at that stage.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just in the developing of something. And we were in Primrose Hill and we were all crawling around and we were doing all kinds of crazy stuff at that time. And that was perceived as quite extreme because we're all tops off barefoot and this stuff wasn't here, right?
Yeah.
It hadn't landed, right? And we were like trailblazing barefoot running and he'd come in with this up with this, there's other movement modalities and blew that open for us. And
yeah.
I was like, okay, I get it now. It's not just running, it's of course there's crawling, there's this. And suddenly we were surrounded in the park by kind of kids.
Yeah.
You know, kids were looking at us to go, oh, wow, you know. And
I want to do that.
Look, there's adults doing this. You know, it's like, oh, look, the adults are behaving very, very differently. And it was very playful. And it was, you know, it was inspiring for the kids, you know. Mm. And I think that's part of it. Again, when did life get so serious? And it's because we divorce ourselves from this stuff. And where can we regain it? Well, in our minds to start with. I held like this 100 human experience, their workshops that I cover and I hold. And we have movement and play and breath and ice baths and ecstatic dance. We brought cacao ceremonies in there. It's a 2-day thing. It's just mind blowing the depth of work that we can cover in 2 days and what the potency is of that. And I would say what people come away with. And there was a woman there called Claire who was 74. And Claire was like this, like really just so fluid and dancing. And just every time we went back to a circle, just opened up and opened up and opened up. And one of the other people on the workshop had said, Claire, so how is it how do you move so freely? I just kind of, why? Because I don't move that freely. Why? How is it you're moving that freely? She went, I freed my mind. You know, and in that moment, because it's when we talk of play, it's a playful state of mind.
Yeah.
It's not a play. We're talking board games and playing tennis and football. It's entering a playful state of mind. We have to all understand. And this is like Dr. Stuart Brown, Professor Stuart Brown, his book Play.
The Play. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, from an evolutionary perspective, it makes absolutely no sense. Right. It makes no sense if play wasn't necessary, right, for our species or any mammal, because all mammals play.
Yeah.
Right? And if it wasn't necessary, we wouldn't have it here today, because from an evolutionary perspective, what isn't necessary is...
just gets cut.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
So you don't grow a new tail, right? It's gone, right?
Yeah.
It's just that's evolution. So with... if we look at the mammals, what risk they take, you've got goats on huge mountaintops, right, leaping around up their plane, right, could mean sudden death at any moment. It's still available. So why is it we remove it, right?
Yeah.
And and we're so drawn to it, and it only takes a moment. I can have people that are very awkward and stiff, perhaps how they even behaved on the tube getting to a workshop. And we see that in the morning. So, yeah. And within 5 minutes of moving around the room and just warm-up practices, that they're so refined now, the practices, that they're an easy in. And all that's happening is this is softening the trust. The oxytocin comes in, trust hormones. Then serotonin starts to come in, right? Because they're trusting for longer and their body parts are coming together for longer. There's endorphins. There's all the happy hormones are starting to be at play themselves. And that's like getting all those happy hormones in a happy hormone shaker and then pop out pops a happy human, right? And that's what can happen through play. But other stuff that's quite extraordinary is the trauma. Like you can release trauma through play. You can release trauma through playful acts.
Yeah.
Physiological trauma, emotional trauma, whatever is stored in the body can be removed through play. And how is that? Well, firstly, it means it's an opportunity for us to imagine ourselves outside of ourselves where we might be stuck and imagine ourselves as something else or someone else. And I say something else or someone else because the studies through play come through Peter Gray, who wrote Free to Learn, which is a we love the book because we're an unschooling, homeschooling family. So it has that unschooling, homeschooling background within the book. And they asked his three independent tribes, what does play look like? What does childhood look like? This isn't play at this stage. It's just asking what childhood looks like. And they asked 10 leading anthropologists. The 10 leading anthropologists firstly say, the kids, you know, these indigenous kids in three different geographic locations, are the most well-adjusted, well-rounded individuals they'd ever met.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what do they do in these 10 different geographic locations, 10 independent tribes? Three independent tribes, sorry. They play from infancy through to teenage years, not adult-led, child-led play, with no adult intervention, and they play at being everything.
Yeah.
And everyone. So. Yeah. They are the plants, the rocks, the animals. They are the elders. And they play every situation. So it's just an act of play. They're playing out what it is to then be the adult. But through that process, they've learned their deeper connections to what it is to be interconnected and interdependent. We're independent, but we're part of an interdependent.
Yes.
Yeah, that's biodiversity, right? It's to really understand what is biodiversity. They are part of that biodiversity. Through playing out everything, the plants, the rocks, the animals. The adults understand it, they won't remove it because they understand it's the most important mechanism for becoming adult because they've learned how to build shelter, to track, to build fire.
Yeah.
And they've learned all the traits, again, by being everyone and everything, sympathy, empathy, compassion, all of that comes through because they know what it's like to be this and they know what it's like to be that. You know, whereas in modern cases, we can see it as it might be the kid on the corner supping a Starbucks on their mobile phone.
Yeah.
They're playing out being an adult. And then we go, well, you shouldn't be on your mobile phone.
Yeah. While you're sitting there like that.
Yeah. Whilst playing on our mobile phone. You know, it's just, and it, when all you see it like that, it's like, wow, okay, that's the power of play. And then we have to question like, well, that state that we then enter through play to become an adult, are they not then just in a playful state of mind as adults?
Mm-hmm.
Then they are in this meditation state. So the monks you were referring to earlier that only need 4 hours sleep, that's partly why, because indigenous cultures are walking around in a playful state and a frequency that you and I can only really achieve through breath work, through meditation, or through deep rest and sleep. They're reported to be in that state. You know, their left and right hemispheres are always massaged, moving through a landscape, being the landscape, being every part of it. You know, that's the real understanding of organic consumption and organic behavior and being, right?
Yeah. This week I went into a school and was doing some, it was for like a spirituality day. And I was asked to go in and do some breath work with them, you know, and I was trying to get across the point that, you know, if you're going to in any way traverse anything of a spiritual life, you have to actually first be able to downshift and be able to soften and all this kind of. But there was some kids who loved it, immediately. I was making it playful because they were like 14, 15. But, you know, there were some girls in particular who they, you know, you would need a lot of time to make them feel safe and to let them down their guard and stuff. But, yeah. you know, it kind of, it got me thinking because my wife and I have spent quite a lot of time in Croatia, and out in Croatia, kids don't start school until sort of 7, 8-ish. And so the idea is they're supposed to be kids up until the age of 8. Whereas I kind of feel over here, it's kind of kids are kids for, you know, till 3, and then they get put in school. And then, you know, you suddenly get them, as you say, in a box, in some shoes, in a tight uniform, and it's mm-hmm. everything's tight. And, you know, you get your little girls group or boys group, and you don't want to look embarrassed in front of them. So it's easier to act up than to be free and play and explore. And it was a really kind of interesting thing for me to see, because I haven't got kids and, you know, I don't have that side of things, but it was really interesting for me to go in and just see how, you know, you've got, we're making 14-year-olds into 40-year-olds, essentially. We're trying to make them adults so at such a young age. Yeah, it kind of was really...
Yeah, I think it's what's missed, isn't it? And who's to say there is an adult and a child if we understand what's happening in those kind of tribal situations? Mm. And I think, firstly, it's a very flawed environment, isn't it? Because we're only ever dropped into the same age group in those yes. environments.
Yeah, so yeah,
we're
yeah.
only
yeah.
ever interacting, social interaction is only ever with the same age group. Or we have an elder that's then the hierarchy in that situation. Yeah. So already there's something that's flawed within that, because we're all sovereign, right?
Yeah.
And then there's acts that are taken away, and there's some kids that are more absorbent. So a lot of the, I'd say what we look to unpack now, because we're living in an amazing time now where we are discussing stuff like this, at least we are discussing it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
How we find our authentic self and our spiritual practices and how we get our needs met. Whereas we had a large window of time where none of that was being considered. So let's be really kind of just appreciative and grateful for the time we're in.
Absolutely.
As gnarly as it seems at times, but actually it's, wow, we've had some amazing, profound moments here where we, and it is about being in the moment, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And appreciative of it. But if we look into what the school moment of what schooling is, then yeah, I mean, you go, imagine you go in and you're a playful being. And we're talking about the age of 7. Most Scandinavians like that. Like
yeah, yeah.
And there is the developmental stages of the brain. I put this in the book as well.
Like, yeah, yeah.
You know, first 3 years, then so on and so on. And we reach these different frequencies that when we reach to like 8 and 9, we're then at what we consider as where we're at now, right? But up until that point, it's these different frequencies of brainwave that then mean we're incredibly absorbent, which is the equivalent to then meditation. Deep breath meditation. And so if we're these playful beings that are primed for absorption, and then we enter a schooling environment that's quite early in that developmental stage, it can be 4 or 5, right?
Yeah.
And suddenly you're then thrust into an environment where you have to sit and you have to be still and you have to put your hand up if you need to go and do something. And already that's the forming of this, it's a cage, right? We, if you think about it, that
yeah, yeah.
what that's actually doing is encaging someone already. And then play is then reduced to a time outside. So you're, yeah. okay, here's an hour. Right, all go out, ring the bell. We can all go out for an hour. Right now you can run around. You let out your cage for a moment to go and run and play.
To burn it off.
And we'll be an adult there to supervise. And you might have to queue up for things before you can climb on them. Or, you know, you might not be able to use that because another kid's on it. That's okay. And then you follow the painted lines or jump on those things or bounce a ball. And already it's becoming more specialized rather than free.
Yeah. You know,
rather than this playful act, it's already, oh, it's a time and a place for play.
Yeah,
so we're already creating a zoo lens of what that might look like. You're allowed out of your cage, you can play, and then you have to go back in again. Right now we go back in, and then it's feeding time at the zoo, right? So now we go out, now we eat, and then we have food, and we go back to our position in our chair, and we're caged there for a moment. It's quite extreme, this, I know, but I'm just trying to break it
yeah,
down.
Yeah, no,
to
no,
how,
not
how it looks, right? And so then that play that we had is no longer appropriate. That's now the lunch break. And play has become PE, so that's now physical education. And through PE, that's where the problems can start with our understanding of movement and exercise.
Yes. Yes.
Suddenly it's very specialized, and you have to have specialist kit, specialist shoes. you have to queue up in a specialist order and you have to go. And some kids are older than others, so they're already stronger. So you already feel inadequate, or you're not marrying up to the ideals of what this should be. Right?
Yeah.
And you then have the hierarchy of the teacher. The teacher will then be picking the ones that are most aligned with that specialist sport at that particular time, because they're primed for it. And everyone else is like left thinking, what's wrong with me? Why not? And then hating the very fact of having to go to PE. Then you throw hormones into all that.
Yeah.
Menstrual cycles into all of that.
Yeah. You know, and the effects on menstrual cycles on the breath as well, and how that suddenly makes, do you know what I mean? And it just,
it's like, it's fascinating. And that's PE. But then you could then say equally, it could be, I'm really interested at the moment in mathematics and WIBS isn't. So I'm absorbent, you're not. So you're going to come away feeling, have feelings and inadequacies. And, you know,
it's
the same across the board, you know.
I am.
And then we have to figure out how to rechild and empower ourselves later on, you see. But we are innately wild, connected, empowered beings. I think that's the deeper message.
The thing that got me was when I, working with Helen Hall at the moment, was the thing that got me, and we were chatting similar things when I was last down seeing her, but we were saying how, you know, because I'm going to bring this on to Barefoot now, because it kind of makes sense with me, but like, you know, her view, especially with all the work she does with like developmental reflex patternings and whatever else you maybe want to call them, is, you know, someone can do something, and it sounds really stupid and obvious, whatever, but you can do it because you can do it. I.e., like, so for me, I love being barefoot. I literally love, I'll run across beaches barefoot. I'll, you know, like, I'm talking Suffolk beaches, so they're stony, not a nice sandy beach. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, and I sent her a video of me doing it, and she was like, you know, she's like, that's got me thinking. And anyway, so she was, next time I saw her, she did lots of tests on my, and she was like, you know, I'm hyposensitive, like in my feet. So, you know, I'm constantly searching for a sensation and a sensory feedback and stuff. And it's kind of like, I can run barefoot because my, whatever happened in my developmental thing has led me to here. So, you know, in schools, you know, you are good at football because your foot eye coordination is good, because when you were a kid, you developed, you know, she likes to call them Lego pieces. So you found these Lego pieces, which, you know, you completely sussed out how your foot and your hand and your eyes all work together. And so therefore it's within your system. So you've got it. But the other boy who maybe missed that, had an injury, whatever else, like didn't pick that piece up, he's not picked it up. So you end up being, well, you're rubbish. So not that they say that, but you know, you're not being picked for this team. You might get picked for the C team. We want you in the A team. And then actually, you know, within those school environments, actually, if they didn't specialize so much, and if they said, actually, we're going to put some movements back into your body, which are really simple, really developmental, really flowy, really rhythmical stuff, which actually then brings everyone onto this same page of, oh, suddenly my eye to foot coordination is drastically improved. And so we could all, if we want to all go and play football, we could all have a much more level playing field to play on. You know, if you have really, really, really sensitive feet and the idea of just walking on grass is hideous, we could do stuff. And so you could walk around barefoot better. And, you know, and it's kind of, for me, that was again, so simple, but you can do it because you can do it. And it's like, oh yeah, that's really...
Well, you can also do it because there's the predispositions to things, aren't there? But there's ultimately the environments that will allow things to become predetermined. And what are those environments? And we could call that, I call this the tribe of influence.
Mm-hmm.
So if we all were in the same tribe, observing the same movement patterns,
yes,
that were all generalist
movements,
we would all still have, there would still be specialist traits, because of course, I might be able to climb up the highest tree to get the honey that's necessary, but everyone will play their role that their skill base is at to ensure that I get the honey.
Yes.
So everyone's role is exactly the same, right?
Yeah.
In getting, receiving honey. If I'm on a hunt, everyone's role
has their place and
within the hunt. It's interdependent again, right? But we're all generalists. We could all carry out parts of that. But if you're divorced from that because of home life now, where both parents are out the house for hours upon end, or single parents are out the house for hours on end, then where is the environment? Well, if it's school, then surely in school, we should be being taught generalist ways of moving, which would then mean nourishing the movement brain itself in things like balancing, running, jumping, crawling, lifting, carrying, throwing.
Yeah.
But not in a specialist sense, but actually in a more generalist sense, putting like movement combos together in a huge environment for kids to all go around together. Maybe that they do it together rather than in competition, because in nature, there isn't the competition.
Yeah.
It's not about that. It's about getting the obstacle around it together.
Yeah.
Communicating as one.
Having that almost team in like,
so what's lost in that process? And then if we talk about the sensitivity of feet, right? You know, the Chris Dort study on that's in the book about the foot strength.
Vivos,
right?
Yeah.
So that's just foot strength improving, 60% foot strength improving after wearing Vivo Barefoot for 6 months. Balance improving by 40%. But what about the sensitivities? So if you wear rubber and you create a rigid foot, of course, when you go to walk on something hard, you're hitting hard on hard. Only when you learn the softening compliance and abilities of all of those 33 articulations, 26 bones, 100 muscles, 10 ligaments, and 200,000 receptors, only when you really understand that, that's extraordinary. That's like your hand, right?
Yeah.
Then you can understand how to soften and move over terrain, right?
And that's what really, when you look at your video, sorry, just to pretty jump in, but when you watch your video, because it's such a perfect example, within the first 3 minutes, you can see it. But like your video of the one man, 2 feet, three peaks, you go up Snowden first thing, and then you come down Snowden, and you can see you lightly as a goat, for want of a better word, traversing up stony, uneven,
rocky, sharp edges,
like everything which everyone would say, you're fucking mental, Tony, what are you doing? But if you've spent your life developing an awareness of your feet in space and in the environment underneath you, it doesn't seem that mental.
No, it's perfect. It has to be within you, because it's mental to assume that you can ever do that in footwear, because footwear that we're talking about for running only started to come in early 70s, 1969 to early 70s. And then we're talking about billions and billions and billions of pounds that have really gone into the aesthetics of footwear, haven't really gone into the function, because the function would mean that I would be trying to mimic the very shape and behavior of a foot that would then lead to the appropriate shapes that could be made over the ground,
right?
And the receiving of that ground. There's a good example in the film, though, because there's the first one, Snowden. Even the camera crew, like the guys from WeMove, Chris,
you were just like,
oh my God, we had no idea. And what it isn't spoken of, I did that the day before on the event as well, because I wanted to just go up there and just warm up. So I did I think it was 149, I think. Anyway, so I ran up, straight back down again, barefoot on the day before, then went up on the second day, and I broke a toe on that. The first day of that event. And then I still had 52 miles to run, and then the next day, then Scafell Pike. And you can see then the difference, though, because Scafell meant that my legs had already had, you know,
200 miles, something, 300 miles.
Six marathons and a mountain in them in a very short window of time.
Yeah.
And so already I was getting this stiff legs. So it felt stiff leg, the shock absorption had gone. So therefore I was feeling then even hard on hard. And then when it finally get to Ben Nevis, I felt some of the elasticity, but it's the cold then that came in. When the cold came in, you have to be more aware. And also your feet get that same stiffening. So it's a great example where it's all done for getting there, isn't it? It's like seeing that, just the difference from the start to the finish of compliance and stiffness can be in barefoot, right?
Yeah. I mean, I am just around that then. So just when you were planning that, did it ever go through your mind to think, I might go and I want to do this. I want to do three peaks. I want to do it barefoot. Did you ever think I might run it barefoot the whole way?
Well, actually, it first was presented to me because I ran Land's End to John O'Groats barefoot.
Yeah.
So I did that first challenge. That was the year before. That was in September of 2018, right? Mm-hmm. 2018?
I think
so. No, 2019.
Is it?
Yeah, and then in the May of 2020, that was when I was meant to be running the Three Peaks. Yeah. And someone had said to me at the end of Land's End, John O'Groats, it was in the Vivo Barefoot team, and we were on an Extinction and Rebellion thing. I was meant to be holding a talk there, and the guys just said, have you thought what's next? Have you thought about maybe doing the Three Peaks barefoot? And I said, well, it feels like it's been done, like the Three Peaks. But what I'd really picked up on was the fact that when I ran Land's End to John O'Groats, if we're talking about a linear experience going from one linear box to the next, it's more natural to run on mountains and trail and sand
than it is grass, on the roads.
Barefoot. I mean, people say, oh, you're crazy running on, you know, this stuff. But actually, it's not like the planet was covered in soft grass, right? We must have been traversing some pretty insane territories, right? And so, but we weren't on one linear plant on this tarmac surface for hours upon end. And so Land's End, John O'Groats proved that to me. It was like soul destroying, both
literally
my soul and the souls of my feet destroying them. So the pads of my feet that I built, because people say, oh, your feet really hard. No, they're like jelly. They're like,
that's the thing,
pads.
Like mine are just, do you know what I mean, it's just like a leathery, like, yeah. I mean, it's not like a callus that you would get on the side of your toe. It's just like a really,
yeah,
I don't know, like a supple piece of like motorbike jacket or something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And so I start, it's like you develop your own, you know, your own Nike bubbles underneath your feet, right? But I started to wear that away on the Land's End, John O'Groats, to the point the skin got really thin. It started to split.
Right.
And so for me, it was like, well, it's natural to run the mountains barefoot, but it's unnatural really to run on tarmac.
Yeah.
And I was really interested in then at later stage, what came out of this was knowing that there was then a record.
Right.
To be beaten. So I looked and I thought, right, the message for me is clearly right. The mountains are nature and the tarmac's unnatural, but let's wear footwear that enables me to, my foot to perform and me to perform how it should do in nature, but give me protection against the unnatural being the tarmac surface or the road.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where Vivo Barefoot came in. So it's kind of like Vivo Barefoot between, which then when you can't be barefoot, for me, was we wear Vivo Barefoot, right? And then on the next event adventure, which is coming up in September, which is the Southwest Coastal Path, that's then all kinds of amazing terrain.
Yeah. I might have to come and join you for some of that, I reckon.
Oh, please do. Come and join a leg. There's lots of people that want to join different legs of that.
Oh, man, it'd be like, that's such a beautiful part of the world to run in and just... Yeah,
I might be less talkative then.
No, that's actually that's understandable. You don't need to. We'll just run together. That'll be.
Yeah.
I did a small stretch when Nick Butter ran the UK when he ran all the outside, and I joined him for the last what was it like 10 miles or something, 6 miles, 6-10 miles as he went back into Eden Project. So kind of as he did that last little stretch there, I kind of went and joined him there, and everyone had his whole like running club and everyone coming out and joining him. And I was joining, I had my Dalmatian with me. I was in a cut off shorts, I think, and a cut off t-shirt with no shoes on. And nice. So I was running with them, like just going all the way. And this woman came up to me and went, did you mean to run this far?
Yeah.
And I went, yeah. She was like, well, my motherly instincts, I'm very worried about your feet. She was like, I thought you had just joined us for the beach bit, and then you just got like, you didn't realize we were still going. I was like, I go everywhere barefoot. It's fine. I know what I'm doing. It just cracked me up. But and on that one, just as another thing, I guess we can go into. I know we've kind of hit the hour near enough already, so we'll have to keep it short, I guess. So I don't want to take up too much of your time, but with breathing and running, because again, like, you know, myself, I'm a breathwork geek. I'm an absolute, I spend my life looking at research, and when I run, it's all nasal, etc. And I know that you're obviously a massive proponent of it. But when I was doing that run with Nick and the running clubs and whatever else, it was a short run, six, 7 miles or something. But it amazed me how running club people were so out of breath and so, it was really, and it wasn't difficult terrain by any means. Do you know what I mean? We were kind of a few hills, but all on road for the most part. There was a little bit of off road trails and on the beach, but not a lot. but how much people struggled. And as a non-runner in myself, certainly that time I definitely classed myself as a non-runner, how much harder work people make their life by, again, I'm going to go back to schools here. You know, I always remember being told, like, breathe in through your nose, out through your mouth. And then, you know, and you end up getting to the stage where you just breathe in and out through your mouth when you can't do through your nose anymore. And watching it, I was just blown away by seeing all of these, you know, okay, they're kind of amateur running club people, but like how it's not a thing to understand basic human physiology of breathing through your nose.
Well, it's becoming a thing. It definitely is. And again, it's all different stages to the path. There's some amazing running clubs that I've been working with that are open to hearing, I think, is some of it, right? It's to be able to look at things with a beginner's mind. It's a very important tool in the modern world, right? One that we all need to kind of, I guess, understand and observe. So I worked with a running group. There were two guys in Ireland working with fell runners. I mean, high level fell runners, like King of the Mountains. And this guy had arrived at my door. This is at the gym that I was talking about. So we're doing way back. And we had a barefoot running philosophy, and he arrived at my door and had 22 running injuries. But he was the coach, who also ran and would put everyone through this system. And it was by Arthur Lydiard. And Arthur Lydiard is a phenomenal track and field coach, right? He was turning basic kind of track runners into Olympians back in the day, right? And yet he would put everyone rather like Salazar was doing with Mo Farah, right?
Yeah.
You have to do 100 miles a week, let's say, right? So putting 100 miles a week through them, and then different routines, out and backs, or being on your feet for 4 hours or whatever, or being out there for 4 hours. And then there was heel training in there. So putting through this whole profile. But no one had discussed posture. No one had discussed the breathing. No one discussed footwork, feet. No one discussed footwear, really. It was just this given that we all know how to run, right?
Yeah.
We are born to run.
Yeah.
But again, that goes back to if you only ever observed your running tribe who all ran how nature intended, and you learn all the other movement modalities and the ground sitting practices that help nurture the form, which is our primary locomotive pattern, which is running.
Yeah.
So if you lived on the ground, didn't live in a chair, you didn't wear footwear that compromised your feet, and you only ever observe running as it was in its purest form, and only ever observe breathing. And there's breathing. Talk even in indigenous cultures where parents see their kids are mouth breathing, they close their lips to encourage nasal breathing.
Right? Absolutely.
So if we understood that, and we also understood breastfeeding was meant to continue for a longer period of time than just we're led to believe in the human zoo, for many reasons, nurturing the emotional brain even, but also the physiological understanding of that. Well, the mouth and the nose, right? Mouths are for
eating and drinking and eating.
And noses are for breathing, right?
Yeah.
So it's within that, it's in the first years, earlier developmental stage. So I think if you only ever observed that, then of course that would be the natural outcome. And then it would be a given that we all know how to run.
Yeah.
But unfortunately it's not. So we've either been compromised by papa, mama, who show us a form of running.
Yeah.
Or we go into a schooling system where the PE teacher also doesn't understand the skill of running, the posture, the rhythm, the tempo, the breath work.
The cadence.
He tries to teach because it's now adult-led play, not child-led learning through the adult's natural learning and observation. So that's where we're at, and that's what it tends to look like. So then we have to strip it back and go, well, what's the natural way of running? What does it look like? And the only place we can go is to then look at running tribes around the world, indigenous
culture and stuff.
Or you look to practices like the pose method from Nicholas Romanoff, who looked at that everyone has to go to a specific posture. And then when you look at that posture, you get it. And then you see that, of course, in natural running tribes around the world, right?
Yeah.
So that's where you take it to. And then breath comes into that. And breath will be, okay, there's tempos of breath that you can play with. Is it so important that, is it okay to breathe out my mouth? Well, if you're so congested and you can't breathe out your nose and you have to run, well, you breathe out your mouth. But in the occasions when you're not and you can practice the skill of everywhere you go throughout your waking life, nasal breathe unless you have to eat or speak, right?
Yeah.
Just try and get it back to it, familiarize it in that sense. There's also what we're up against, I think, with running and people within running clubs, and what I experienced through coaching for many years in that realm of bringing technique in breath, technique in movement, technique in running form, mm-hmm. is that, yeah, but that's going to make me slower.
Yes, that ego.
And so that's what you have to firstly be able to deal with. And that's where the beginner's mind and the empty cup comes in.
Yeah.
Of that understanding of learning. Well, actually, we're looking at longevity here.
Yes.
So the running coach that come to see me within 6 months, 22 running injuries had gone. We then developed a whole movement practice for his runners. So the runners were then getting the 100 miles a week through their body, but with the same template or same understanding of the realms of which the Arthur Lydiard days were. So we were not talking about a sitting culture who were wearing compromising footwear back then.
Yeah, at least.
To rewild them back to then meant that they, of course, were performing the task at a much more authentic, but they were also way, but also becoming more resilient within that practice too, right? Which meant that they could then go on and run many 100 miles, not just, oh, I've run 100 miles now, I'm completely broken. You know, and the idea is we should be able to get up and go and do the same thing again the day after. And that's where breath does come in, because personally, what I found through nasal breathing is not just the performance on the day, the efficiency on the day, but also my recovery's been much better, you know?
There we go. I don't know what happened there. People think that, like, so I've been running around my town recently, and I mean, my town must think I'm mental, because last year we had a massive flood in a field, and then it froze over. So I was going down and I hacked a massive hole in the ice and was like ice bathing, and it got shared to the local Hadley Facebook page, and everyone was like saying how dangerous it was, and you know, I was going to die of hypothermia and stuff. But now at the moment I'm running barefoot and I'm taping my mouth shut. So I've trained with Patrick McEwen numerous times and all sorts. So I'm running around my town barefoot, mouth taped shut, shirt off type thing. And for me, you know, I can literally, I'll take my tape off at the end of my run and I'll record myself and I'll be like, look, and take it off and I'll immediately be able to talk in full sentences. Mm. And I'm going to immediately be able to show like a calm, quiet nasal breathing. And you can go into actually, you know, physiologically, your recovery at this point is already started. You don't have to and try to downshift, and you know, you're already 4 steps ahead to start your recovery. And for me, that's kind of what I see, you know, when I was watching again your video, which I'm going to put in the notes for everyone, because it's definitely a half an hour worth watch. You know, you finished your, I want to say it's your first day, I think it was after the first day it showed it, you finished your first day after doing Snowden, running 50 miles, and then it was kind of like, chill out, stop, lie down, breathe, slow, full nasal breathing, into the ice bath, get your breath under control, slowed it all down. And, you know, it's still, I mean, it's so hard sometimes when you're in it and you know it and you're kind of a geek about breathing and breath work, that it just seems baffling that people wouldn't know it or see it straight away. But, you know, the ability to downshift and to become more aware and to slow down and, you know, just for the recovery side is so huge. And as you were kind of saying about the running clubs and, oh, I don't want to run slower, oh, my ego, this and that, but understanding that this thing here, your nose will just, if you just, you don't need any technology. You can suddenly.
That's the game changing work, isn't it? That you, I used to put it out there way back in the Landon John O'Groats days. I put it out there that when I flipped to nasal breathing, I had to go from like the guys are talking about in the running clubs. I had to get slower.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I went from like 8-minute miles to 10-minute miles. But I knew I'd just trust it, respect it, be patient, and I would be rewarded, right? And so through that was trust the process, respect the process, be patient whilst in it, and the rewards will come. And before I knew it, yes, down to 8-minute miles. But something more extraordinary was happening. I was super calm after the run. Down-regulated when I arrived back. I didn't come back a sweaty mess.
Yeah.
And I then would understand that the nasal breath would just determine my pace the whole time. Mm-hmm. So wherever I went, it would all be nasal breathing. The moment I started to breathe through my mouth, I was pushing too hard. And then it helped me understand this language of flow, don't push.
Yeah.
And through flowing, we can then be more playful in the act, even playful with breath, playful with running. That's what we're talking about. And I think also it enables you to wear, it's a different attitude completely. I think largely the that stuff, it's also inherited. It's what we've observed. Yeah. So we're playing that anyway. It's like, oh, I'm tired. Oh, I've had an exhausting day. And it's like, well, actually, if we're more conscious through breathing, that doesn't play out either. It's like, you know, I had someone just I was working with at the weekend and incredibly stressed. I mean, in the modern world of success right now, that's what they're in, and they're striving and striving, and burnout is present, and doing whatever they can to support that of all means. And we just went through breath again.
Yeah.
And those simple acts of like, let's just practice this on the hour, every hour, just do this breathing technique.
That's, I mean, for me, that's, I mean, you can almost use that as your thing if you like, but it's up to you. I mean, I've kept you for more than an hour, so we'll have to kind of get to wrap up, so you can, I don't want you, you know, being behind. But for me, and then that's something which when I read your book, I've used with some of my clients as well, is that idea of, you know, you don't trying to get someone to sit down and do, if they've never done it before, trying to get someone to sit down and do 10 minutes or 15 minutes of breath work is really difficult. It's like, if you're not used to it, it's horrible. And this is what I always say about meditation as well, is, you know, I come from a yoga background. So in yoga, in the eight limbs, meditation comes after movement and breathing. And so, you know, when I hear doctors and stuff now prescribing meditation, it kind of irks me a little bit, because people are not ready. You're never going to get any benefit from meditation unless you can do the other bits first. You know, that there's a reason near enough 3,000 years ago, Patanjali wrote, you know, that there's yamas and niyamas, and that's your life, that's your 10 commandments. And then you've got your asana, and you prepare your body to sit, and then you prepare your breath to calm you and shift you down to then let meditation take its place.
Mm.
And
and
for me, it's that thing of, I don't know, really just that's the key that we need to get into someone first, and get them to understand that if they're going to do anything, they need to remove the ego. They need to learn to be able to sit, and they need to be able to find that 1 to 2 minutes of, I want to be able to meditate, or I want to be able to do breath work. But every time I sit down, my mind goes, and I've got too many thoughts.
Yeah.
And your idea that you write in the book is something that I've used on clients before, but, you know, set your alarm or just watch the clock, and every time an hour ticks by, just do like six breaths, like do six slow, simple, 10 simple, slow breaths. It's like a minute and a half, 2 minutes of breathing, and then forget about it, and do it again on the next hour, and then forget about it, and then do it. And that will very quickly give you such a huge awareness of just breathing and of life, that actually it will just begin to seep into your life without even needing to try harder.
That's 100%. Yeah, I call it a reboot. It's this opportunity just to check in every hour, on the hour, waking hour.
Mm. Yeah, don't set your alarm at night.
You know, and don't obsess, because I think also we go down this path of, right, I have to count or do boxes. And
yes, 4 seconds. Yes.
Just try and inhale up through your nose into a soft, relaxed belly. 4 seconds, yeah, but just inhale for as long as you can. And exhale, try and extend the exhale, because again, we know, put your fingers on your pulse will pick up on an inhale, pulse drops off on the exhale, more associated with rest and digest, parasympathetic, extend the exhale, and six of those. And you'll find six of those, if it is around 4 to 6 seconds, that's a minute, and you're hard pushed not to find the minute, right? So it's like,
yes,
I'll be a minute absolutely late. I'd rather be a minute late for something than turn up an upregulated mess.
I was going to say, be a minute late, but be in a position to actually, like, be able to absorb what you're doing.
Arrive. Like, I had one person I was
consciously arrive,
and she tuned into, through breath, a being state, not a doing state.
Yeah.
And she said, oh my God, I was holding it. I was in a meeting. It was the first time I really understood what you meant. And I was being myself in the meeting. Can you imagine? Like, we have to, we've reached this state now where we don't know what even really when we're being ourselves or how to be ourselves. That's one thing. But also, it was, you know, that's the difference between being on a Zoom call and doing a Zoom call.
Yeah.
Being in a meeting and doing a meeting. Or just going to a meeting. It's actually being in the meeting, being present.
Being present.
And that might be a job interview, an exam, or whatever it is. But I know when someone's being authentic or not. You know, I know when someone's upregulated or downregulated. And to think that someone else doesn't recognize that in me would be absurd, right?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
So it's, how do you want to be received? I'd want to be received how I receive others. And it was just trying to remain, understand that, that before you even walk in the room, even just one breath, just think about exhale as you walk in the room.
Yeah.
Just to find that. And nobody in that room, also this is a great tip, no one in that room knows whether you're breathing up and down your nose, right?
Yeah.
You could be just calmly standing like this.
Absolutely.
And do six cycles in a space. And if you have like any ADHD tendencies, then breath again. Focus in six breath cycles in the space. If you feel like, again, I'm getting upregulated, it's too overwhelming, too many voices, too many heads in the room, bring it back to breath. You know, it's so valuable.
You know? I mean, I am just to, you know, there's two things I'll just round off on that, which kind of, one I found fascinating, one that kind of annoys me, I'm going to say, maybe not annoys me, but just in the, you know, breath work is becoming very popular and stuff, but, and there's a lot of people who very much kind of, they read the research papers and it's very much like 4 seconds in, 6 seconds out. And you're like, mate, have you ever worked with like real people? Because there's a lot of people, you ask them to breathe in for two or three seconds and that's a challenge. You know, so what you said was you just, you know, just a slightly extended, a slightly, you know, soft belly, soft diaphragm, soft pelvic floor, all of that, like, and then just the exhale, which I thought, you know. But the other thing was, I don't know if you know it, see him or not online, there's a guy called Matt Dewar. He's a doctor in America, but he's a doctorate type thing. He works in schools, does a lot of mindful work with teenagers and things.
Nice.
But I listened to a podcast with him, and I think he used it as a, he does lots of research with, not Feinstein, one of the other ones, I can't remember what his name is, one of the big breath researchers in America. Anyway, he did this thing where he got a kid to overbreathe for 3 minutes. And then said, right, read this paragraph, this text. And so they sat there and they overbreathed, half recovered, read the text, said, right, put it down, said, what did you just read? What, you know, can you tell me anything about what you just read? Nothing, not a thing. Couldn't remember any of it. Like it, they'd read it, but they hadn't read it.
Yeah.
And for me, that's exactly like what you've just said, is like being and doing, like by slowing, breathing, you know, down, you can be in that moment and you can read that thing, you know, you can absorb that thing. You know, what I was trying to say to these kids at schools was, you know, you're coming up to your exams and like you're all over breathing, hyperventilating, you know, you're all up here. And actually, if you want to, you know, before you go into your exam, like six rounds, slow breathing as you walk in and you sit down, you'll open that paper and you'll be able to read and think what you're doing. Obviously some of them are like, oh, that's interesting. Some of them are just like, yeah, but there you go.
Again, that room and that experience will determine how a lot of their lives play out.
Exactly.
And that's the travesty, because the schooling system, the teachers, this should be just this is part of taking an exam. This is part of going into these experiences,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, that again, ultimately how their life will play out.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
And you'll hear all kinds of voices coming in that exam room, you know, all kinds of stuff will be coming up for you.
Yeah.
If you haven't downregulated. And again, it's such a simple act, right? It's just such a simple act. Just
unbelievably.
Six cycles. Now go in, see how you feel.
Yeah.
And take them through mock exams of, well, the mock exam is we're going to practice these modalities to go and do the real thing.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
It's so obvious, right?
Is it though?
it's
it incredible. Should be obvious. It should. Yeah, what do they say about common sense not being that common these days?
Yeah, exactly.
But, well, Tony, we've gone over the hour, but thank you so much for actually hanging around and chatting a bit longer, because I mean, I've got, as you can see, I've got loads we didn't touch on, but I honestly think that if anyone wants to find out more about what I was going to ask, then they can just find you online. Obviously I've done the we've kind of touched on so much, but with the Move, Breed, Live, one tip for someone if they're going to take it away, it can be the breeding if they want, or if you've got anything else.
I have a trifecta, so that's three things, right?
Cool.
So the trifecta would be breathing. Yeah, exactly. Take that away of the extended exhales, inhale up through the nose, extended exhales, relax the pelvic floor, relax the lower abdomen, let the jaw go, the shoulders go, just six cycles on the hour, every hour. Nature studies suggest that 20 minutes in nature is enough to lower heart rate, blood pressure. There's also other experiences that come through there, like phytoncides and terpenes. So they're antibacterial, antifungal. So they're the effects of just being in nature. Then you get grounding influences and everything else. But if we look at the real studies of what we have today, we understand that there's amazing phytoncides that have antiviral, antibacterial, plus anti-cancer properties, plus this lowering of heart rate. Get into nature.
Yeah.
Then if you mix breathing and being out in nature,
yeah,
you know, already think of how amazing you're going to feel. And then understand that, well, it means that in my everyday environment, that's where I'm really at.
Yeah.
How is it that I'm doing this in such short? This is the natural kind of frequency we want to be in. But then understand how much of that can I take into my everyday environment. Breath is one. We touched on bringing more nature in. That's great. And then there's movement for me. How we move through a landscape. So just start tuning into what I call our super biostructure. Think about your posture. Think about keeping your head up, your chest up. Think about looking out into the world, improving that visual field that is then associated again with being down-regulated and parasympathetic. And I have a saying of lead with the heart, let your feet follow. So think about looking out into the world rather than looking down at your phone or down at the ground. And with that, back into the nature stuff of this sky time over screen time. You know,
yeah, I love that
phrase. Get out there, lift your head up, lift your chest up, don't look down at your screen, just absorb stuff, you know.
Yeah,
new experiences, and try and become more tuning into the fact with these incredible emotional experiential species, you know. Just that's it for me.
I love it, because that pretty much ties in with the name of the podcast being Move, Breathe, Live. Move, breathe, and get in nature and live it.
Exactly.
There we go. Well, thank you so much. Briefly, before we do sign off, where can people find you? And have you got one? Have you got one? You got it there? Oh, no, I thought you might
have a book. Yeah, I have a book. There we go. More Human. So that is How to Transform Your Lifestyle for Ultimate Health, Happiness, and Vitality. Tony, that's in all good bookstores. It's on Audible.
I was going to say, I audio booked it when I drove to Cornwall the other week. And you read it, which is brilliant, obviously.
Yeah, but that's me. Yeah, it's me reading it. And then www.tonyriddle.com. Instagram is at the Natural Lifestylist. So perfect. Pretty much on between the Natural Lifestylist and my website.
I'll put all of that in the bio stuff for this episode. We'll get ourselves signed off, and I'll have a very brief chat with you afterwards. But thank you so much for coming and joining me. It's been a bloody
pleasure. Thanks for the invite, man. Great to be on.
My pleasure. Cheers, guys. We'll see you all next week.